Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We sat down with Christine Lagarde this morning, the head of the IMF, to talk about the American economy. Question number one was, are we doing it right, finally?
Yes and no.
Honest, that's how it starts. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 16th of June. The International Monetary Fund issued its annual report on the state of the American economy today. Fine, basically, is the upshot. There is a bunch of stuff the IMF figures we need to improve on, though. Fiscal policy, for one, that is taxing and spending. Monetary policy, for another. The Federal Reserve and how it tells us what it's doing with interest rates. And the labor market and how we get more people in this country making decent wages. Christine Lagarde is the managing director of the IMF, as I said. And when we talked this morning, I started with that first bit, taxing and spending, and whether the IMF is satisfied that Congress now has its economic act together.
Yes and no. Great that at least there was a deal on last year's budget.
Mm-hmm.
That is good. And please continue doing this job. Try to agree amongst yourself about what are the key budget items going forwards. And it may very well include this medium-term fiscal consolidation path that should be had.
In other words, you want more revenues to improve growth. You want us to fix our tax structure. All of those things that, again, have been said before.
They may have been said before, but we are going to continue to say it until they happen. If the voices are strong enough and if we keep at it, there will hopefully be a path for, as I said, this medium-term fiscal consolidation, mm-hmm. short-term focus on investment in the U.S. That's what we're saying, you know, essentially. Invest in the U.S. Mm-hmm. The productivity is low, and therefore it's a question of investing in the right places. Innovation, education, infrastructure.
The problem, of course, is that when you say investment, there are those in the United States, mostly on the Republican side of the aisle, who hear government spending, and that gets you nowhere in a very big hurry.
It doesn't necessarily have exclusively government spending. There can be enough encouragement to private sector funding. When you look at innovation, for instance, there were some, you know, interesting tax breaks that were available for innovation. Certainly this one could be reinstated, and that would encourage the private sector to invest in the right place.
When you say medium term, what do you mean?
Beyond 1 year, and things that would actually stick, you know, commitments. And by the way, on the minimum wage, it's really based on the observation of numbers. When we look at numbers and we see that there are 50 million Americans that are below the poverty line, many of whom are actually working poor, we're saying two things. Increase the EITC, which puts a bit more on the table.
Earned income tax credit, right.
Yeah. Earned income tax credit, yeah. And we're saying couple that with an increase in the minimum wage, which for the case of the United States is one of the lowest of all the OECD countries. So it's not as if we were proposing something that is revolutionary, but we're suggesting that more money be put in the hands of those who actually work so that they can spend.
About the Federal Reserve, you want Janet Yellen, the chair of the Federal Reserve, to have press conferences once a month. You want them to publish quarterly monetary policy reports to make sure that we all know more of what the Fed is thinking. I'm going to guess that you've spoken with Janet Yellen about this over a cup of coffee someplace, or are you just publishing this in a report for the first time?
It was actually over salad
okay.
that we shared. Not a cup of coffee. And clearly what we are prescribing is the best case scenario
yeah.
and a direction to take. We're not suggesting that she gives press conference every month from tomorrow onwards. But we're saying this. There is uncertainty on the one hand, because when you look at employment numbers, when you look at the participation rate in the job market, mm-hmm. when you look at the unemployment numbers and how fast they've gone down, you have lots and lots of questions that are not answered. At the other end, when you look at the markets and you talk to market people, they seem to be overly confident and certain of when tapering will happen and how fast, when tightening will take place and how interest rates are going to move up. Well, we believe that there has to be a reconciliation between uncertainty on the one hand, certainty on the other one. And who best than the Fed chair can do that?
Do you worry at all about the IMF being perceived as an organization that is constantly telling others what to do, being the scold, saying, listen, you have to do this so we can get here? I mean, it does seem that you guys spend a lot of time doing that.
Well, we do. And it's part of the mission of the IMF. We were tasked to do that by the founders. Now, it's not always pleasant. You know, we are often criticized. We're often regarded as, the tellers of the hard truth. But so be it. That's what we were asked to do.
You know, last time we spoke, which was, a couple of years ago, I asked you whether you had confidence that the Congress and the American people would figure out the right thing to do. And you said, in essence, I always have confidence in the Americans. The world has confidence in the Americans.
Yep.
Do you still believe that?
Yes, I do. And it's firmly rooted in Alexis de Tocqueville and many other writers about the United States of America. Oscar Wilde, amongst others as well.
Not an American, but okay.
Not an American, no. He was a typical Brit, actually.
Yeah.
But he said, among other things, that youth is a tradition for the United States of America. In the same vein, I would hope that confidence and confidence building is also typical of the United States. And, it might take time, but clearly the budget deal that was cut, a few months ago is an indication that even when people are at each other's throat, they can eventually cut a deal and find something that they agree upon, which is good.
Christine Lagarde is the Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, there was a little bit of deal making, not a whole lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In northern Iraq today, the Sunni militant group ISIL captured the city of Tal Afar. And in the category of strange bedfellows, the White House said this morning there will be talks about what's going on in Iraq with Iran. No coordinated military options, they were careful to say, but talks nonetheless. Among the many, many people keeping a close eye on all this stuff are oil traders figuring out how to work something called the risk premium into their calculations. Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
Oil traders are gathering intel. They may have contacts in Iraq, someone there actually counting barrels.
You kind of price in the worst case scenarios and then you wait to see if that actually happens.
Phil Flynn is in Chicago. I got a hold of him on the Price Futures Group's trading floor.
Right now, this is a big blow to the global oil market.
Risk is being factored in, so prices are up. Jim Burkhardt is the head of global oil market research for IHS. He says Iraq exports around 2, maybe 2.5 million barrels a day. And traders are worried about what would happen if the world lost access to that oil.
We don't have a wide margin for error in terms of spare capacity.
That's production that could be brought online quickly.
Think of that as our emergency supply in case there's a disruption.
It's Saudi Arabia that has most of that spare capacity. Burkhardt says what worries traders is the total worldwide is roughly equal to what Iraq exports. Analysts had been optimistic about Iraq. There'd been talk of new pipelines and of boosting production. Sarah Emerson is with ESAI Energy.
That's kind of been taken off the table.
But traders shouldn't overreact, says Paul Sullivan. He teaches courses on energy security at the National Defense University.
The oil is coming out of Iraq without much disruption except for psychological disruption.
But when it comes to the price of oil, that can be powerful. Even though it takes several weeks for oil to get from the Persian Gulf to U.S. refineries, gas prices are already going up. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
About two-thirds of the price you pay for a gallon of gas, by the way, is the cost of crude oil. What's the rest of it? We broke that down for you at marketplace.org. Tal Afar, the city that fell to the militants this morning, is about 60 miles west of Mosul, Iraq's second largest city that ISIL took last week. 60 miles on the other side of Mosul is the Kurdish city of Erbil, where things are very, very different. The BBC's Rami Rahayem is in Erbil. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, what's it like day to day up there with all that's gone on in the last week or two?
Well, in Erbil, it's life as usual, but of course the takeover of Mosul triggered a much larger chain of events across Iraq, and now it's not just Mosul that's in the eye of the storm, it's the entire country.
What do you see, though? Do you see food shortages? Do you see prices going up? Is there gas at gas stations?
Of course, here where I am in Erbil, yes, but when we went closer to Mosul, we didn't actually get there. The price of petrol is higher than it is here. There are some shortages. The people we spoke to who are going back say it's okay. They say they have nothing to fear as civilians from the militants, and that was one of the more surprising things we heard. They only feared an Iraqi army assault in order to chase the militants out, and they also said services were okay.
These refugees, these displaced people, are they women and children? Did the men stay to fight? Who is on the move?
Everybody is on the move. Women, children, men, families. We saw different classes. There are people with money who come into Erbil. Some of them actually went into hotels or rented apartments, but they're not really visible. There isn't any visible refugee or internally displaced people. But those who are less well off basically stayed in camps on the outskirts of these cities.
If it gets worse in Mosul and the rest of Iraq, do you suppose the Kurdish provincial government is equipped to handle displaced people? What's going to happen to that?
Well, they're extremely organized, and they do have the support of NGOs who immediately came here. Probably, yes, they are equipped. Of course, they are already under pressure. There are many Syrian refugees as well here, and there are refugees from other parts of Iraq who fled fighting, for example, in the western province of Anbar. But they're actually doing a really good job of handling it, and it's probably because of the organization and the security and the prosperity that this province is enjoying, in very sharp contrast to the rest of Iraq.
I confess I am struck by how many times you have said Erbil is safe and the Kurdish region is safe, and not 60 miles down the road, it's chaos.
It's incredibly striking. We were just walking in the park here and thinking exactly the same thing you just said. Basically, there's militant entity that's on the rise along the borders of this Kurdish province. There are bombings daily, almost bombings that go on in all parts of Iraq, which have been going on ever since the American invasion in 2003. This has not stopped. Throughout all of this instability and violence continuous in Iraq for more than 11 years, this place has been mostly safe. Of course, in the beginning, you know, about 2004, 2005, this city did see maybe a few suicide attacks. There were a few security incidents, but nothing compared with the rest of Iraq, and quite far off. It's been very safe for a long time, and prosperous as well.
Rami Ruhaim, he's the BBC's correspondent. We got him in Erbil in northern Iraq. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
There was a time when a cup of coffee would run you 35 cents and a college education could be had for a couple of $1,000s a year. Now a latte costs you $3 and change, and college, I don't even really think we need to go there, do we? Enter then Starbucks. It said today it's going to help foot the bill for its employees to get a degree. It will pick up a portion, sometimes a large portion, of the tab for online classes at Arizona State University. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains why.
Listening to the Starbucks webcast today was a little like those publishers' clearinghouse ads, where they give a really big check to an unsuspecting, overwhelmed winner.
I started as a barista, now I'm a store manager. And when we heard the news on the news, my daughter started jumping up and down because she said, finally, you can graduate.
Yeah, I got choked up too. But this is not all about feel-good corporate citizenship giving back. It's good business. Zeynep Tan is a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management.
Starbucks will certainly attract better employees.
Becoming a barista is likely to get a whole lot more competitive. And this sort of benefit will lure exactly the sort of employee Starbucks wants. Young, highly motivated. Maureen Conway is with the Aspen Institute.
I think, yes, they are competing for the cream of the crop and low-wage workers.
And Starbucks isn't the only company looking to sweeten the pot for its workers, even its part-timers. FedEx, UPS, others offer tuition reimbursement. Gap raised its minimum wage this year. Elizabeth Malatestinik is a professor at the Kelly School of Business in Indianapolis. She says not all employers feel the need to compete for the best of the best.
Some employers are willing to get what they can get for the lowest wage they can pay.
At some level, she says, the decision comes down to the culture of the business. Also, it's a lot cheaper for Starbucks to help employees get degrees than it is to pay them enough to afford the high and getting higher cost of college. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's about $95 to play a round of golf. Okay, well, love golf, but I'm not $95 worth of golfing per round.
Yeah, no. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials advanced 5 points today, closed at 16,781. The NASDAQ up 10 points. That's about 0.25%. Ended things at 4,321. The S&P 500 up a point, almost 10%, closed at 1,937. Medical device firm Covidien jumped more than 20% today. Industry giant Medtronic is buying the company in a deal worth almost $43 billion. The combined entity, called Medtronic PLC, as they do over there, will be based in Ireland, where corporate taxes, as it happens, are lower. Medtronic dropped 1.1% on the news today. Williams Company surged 18.75%. The pipeline operator has agreed to acquire control of Access Midstream Partners for almost $6 billion. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.59%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases a consumer price index. It lets us know if consumers paid more or less for stuff in May than they did in April. The Senate Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee holds a hearing on creating jobs through bio-based manufacturing. And start thinking about broccoli, beets, and Brussels sprouts. Tomorrow is Eat Your Vegetables Day. Don't argue with me. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Argentina is 1-0 in group play in the World Cup down in Brazil. The Argentines lost a big one this morning in the U.S. Supreme Court, though. The justices declined to hear an Argentinian appeal on whether Buenos Aires has to pay back more than $1 billion to bondholders who've been fighting to get their hands on their money ever since Argentina defaulted back in 2001. The decision puts the Argentinian government firmly on the hook for the money and, its lawyers say, could force the country back into default all over again. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains the decision could also make it harder for other countries in financial trouble to get back on their feet.
After Argentina defaulted in 2001, it eventually got 90% of its creditors to accept pennies on the dollar of their investments. Wyn Thin is head of emerging market strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman.
They took a very hardline approach.
But a few investors said, no deal. We want all of our money back. They sued, saying, we don't care if everyone else agreed to lose their money. We didn't agree. And if you're paying them money, you have to pay us, too. The U.S. courts agreed, and Argentina may now default.
They just simply can't afford to pay this right now.
Bad for Argentina, but this is unlikely to spread into some regional or global financial crisis. Investors have generally stayed far away from Argentina since its default, but this may cause global problems in other ways.
You're sort of messing with a system that's working pretty well.
This is Peter Hakem, President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue. When a country can't pay its debts, it usually does what Argentina did. Maybe not as aggressively, but it tries to get some proportion of investors to agree to take a haircut.
It's rare that you ever get 100% of the creditors accepting it.
The process could be much harder if you do indeed need to get every last investor on board. Eric LeCompte runs Jubilee USA, a religious global financial reform group.
This case will impact debt restructurings all over the world. It'll impact poor country access to credit.
LeCompte says money earmarked for development could be and is being diverted to pay creditors. LeCompte says for all the countries who have debt, it's a warning that getting out of that debt could prove much harder than anyone thought. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The highest apartment rents in this country are... Yeah, no, not New York City, not San Francisco. Try Williston, North Dakota. The oil and gas boom out there has more than doubled the population in just a couple of years, so demand for housing is crazy high. Man camps, company dorms, basically, are the new normal. And even they come with caveats. For instance, shopping. If Walmart doesn't have it, you are driving at least 2 hours to get it, which is why an investment fund from Switzerland says it's planning a $500 million shopping mall there. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Jeff Lunnan is a real estate developer from California. About 3 years ago, he and his partners went to Williston to check out the fracking boom's business prospects.
It was very hard for us to get accommodations and hard to get something to eat and trucks going in every direction.
In other words, unlimited opportunity.
We went back in 2 weeks and started buying real estate, and it's been very good for us.
He's stayed focused on serving the needs of the energy industry itself. Developing retail, that's harder.
You know, it's a little bit like building a retail project on the moon. There's some logistical issues.
For instance, who's going to work in the shops? Where are they going to live? In the man camps? Also, how can you pay them enough to make it worthwhile? In the oil fields, unskilled 19-year-olds make $80,000 a year. Traditional lenders haven't been quick to get involved. John Geese oversees business banking for Wells Fargo in North Dakota.
We are looking to avoid what I would refer to as overcapacity.
In other words, when things level off, will there be more malls than even a built-up Williston needs? No one knows for sure how many people live and work in Williston now. 25,000? 35,000? Meanwhile, like Jeff Lunnan, Wells Fargo has plenty to do in a line that's more of a sure thing, working with energy producers.
Supporting that industry and having equipment and construction loans and such will have a quicker payback, and you can see that more clearly.
Now, a Swiss investment firm called Strapeak is making the gamble. $500 million going into housing, hotels, and 1.2 million square feet of retail. Don Fuller from Jones Lang LaSalle is managing the build-out and soliciting tenants. He says phase one will focus on commodities.
Grocery, pharmacy, and in that area we consider theater commodity, which is a little different, but you know, there's not a lot of entertainment.
Maybe a department store, some women's fashion. He hopes to have that up and running in about 3 years. The whole project, 7 to 10.
We've got a lot of work to do on the site plan, the financial model. All I can say is we think it's going to be profitable. How profitable, you know, remains to be seen.
He says he's never done a project in a location like this before. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The line between economic development and gentrification can be a fine one, a very fine one that often comes with a whole lot of tension. It happens in neighborhoods, it happens in commercial districts, and it happens with golf courses. Kate Davidson reports now from Washington, D.C., home, as it happens, to three public golf courses, all of them owned by the federal government.
These guys pulling up in their cars and unloading their clubs at D.C.'s historic Langston Golf Course, these guys have been at it a long time.
I've been playing here for, 50 or 60 years.
Charlie Green has a regular game with his buddy, John Gwynn.
He's been beating me lately, but that's going to change the day.
That may change, but Green wants everything else about this neighborhood course, a haven for African-American golfers, to stay the same. Right now, he can play 18 holes for $18, though he wouldn't mind better cart paths and maybe more sand in the sand traps. But that's it.
Because if they make it Augusta, they're going to price it out of my range.
He's talking about an idea proposed by some city council members to study a redesign of Langston that would turn it into a PGA championship course with a AAA Four Diamond restaurant and adjoining wine bar. D.C.'s lone Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton also thinks the courses need work.
It's like seeing all these jewels on the ground and say, why doesn't somebody pick them up and do something with them? They're valuable.
Her idea is to transform the East Potomac River course with its monument views into a world-class course with fees to match.
It probably could cater to the lobbyists and the other rich people who come here because the Congress is here.
They'd fly in, lobby, lobby, lobby.
And for the day, when they finish lobbying all of us,
they'd head out and fork out for a round of golf. Norton says higher fees at East Potomac could keep fees low at the other federal courses, which are all operated by a private company. But golfer Butch Duval doesn't want to get priced out of East Potomac. He won't even play on the new Jack Nicklaus course that just opened in Virginia.
It's about $95 to play a round of golf. Okay, well, love Jack, love golf, but I'm not $95 worth of golfing per round.
Right now, these are all just ideas about sustainability and how to use the city's assets. But does it even make sense to build a trophy course in today's golf economy? Jim Copenhaver of Pellucid Corp, which advises golf clients, says not really.
We've overbuilt what we call premium, penal, and pristine courses in the country.
In other words, there are already too many immaculate, difficult courses that are pricey to maintain and play. Americans are playing 50 million fewer rounds of golf than they did in 2000. So Copenhaver says supply should be built in line with what the average golfer wants. Fun.
The majority of them, they enjoy golf for the challenge of it. They enjoy it for its outdoors. They enjoy it for the social experience. And they somehow tolerate the fact that you're never going to be very good at it.
Unless you spend a lot of time on it. Question is, how much money you spend along the way. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we learn, and not for the first time either, that capitalism can be a perilous place indeed. Greenpeace, the environmental group, disclosed this morning it's lost $5.2 million due essentially to a rogue trader. They had a guy in their finance division who was working currency trades as a way to hedge against other investment fluctuations. Two things happened. Number one, he traded way more money than he was authorized to. And number two, he bet the euro would fall last year. It didn't, so he lost. Yes, $5 million is a boatload of money. The group's annual revenues, though, are somewhere near $400 million. Every year, which is what annual means. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Millie Jefferson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.